15-minute break. Okay, we're going to get into the groundfish issues. Before we start on that, I've had a request for an individual to read something into the record. Dave Gaethel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. In light of our discussions yesterday on conflict of interest, I think it's incumbent to read several things into the record. The first is my resignation from the Board of Directors of the Northeast Seafood Coalition. The letter reads, in light of November 13th discussion by NOAA General Counsel on conflict of interest, I am tendering my resignation from the Board of Directors of the Northeast Seafood Coalition as of this date. While the NSC members control more than 10% of the groundfish complex allocation, the NSC board has no allocation and no control over members' allocations. The NSC board is a volunteer position on a nonprofit organization that helps to develop education and policy guidance for its executive director on behalf of its membership. While I personally do not think that this presents a conflict of interest as stated in Magnuson-Stevens, I would have to recuse myself from all final votes on groundfish matters until a definitive ruling could be obtained from the Department of Commerce. My time on the council is short, with many final votes scheduled soon. My resignation should in no way be construed as a statement on current NSC policy or policy under development, but rather a practical decision for the issue at hand. I look forward to working with you again when my term expires on the New England Fisheries Management Council in August. And I have a second letter to the council. It's addressed to Mr. Cunningham. I request that the Department of Commerce General Counsel present definitive written guidance to all councils on whether being on an unpaid board of directors of a nonprofit organization whose members cumulatively control more than 10% of a fishery allocation constitutes a conflict of interest. I further request the Department of Commerce Council define whether this extends just to the species the organizations develop policy for, or all species for which members hold permits, which may aggregate to more than 10% of those species. I further recommend to my fellow council members that they resign from boards of directors, both commercial and recreational, whether paid or voluntary, until definitive written advice is obtained from general counsel. In lieu of that action, I would request that all council members recuse themselves at the beginning of all final votes for any species which their organization's members cumulatively control more than 10% of the species allocation. And I've submitted copies of both letters to Karen for the record.
Thank you. Anybody else? Terry?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I did the same thing as Dave did, effective yesterday. So I wouldn't have to recuse myself from anything. So.
Anyone else? Okay. Terry, I'll turn the meeting over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. As usual, Tom, Fiona, Andy, and the CAT team have been pretty darn busy in their large number of materials behind tab 3 and on the table. I want to highlight for today's meeting summaries from the committee, two committee meetings and the PDT CAT memo. Since our last meeting in September, the committees met twice, the PDT three times, and the recreational and groundfish advisors have also met. But that being said, there's still a significant amount of work to be done before our final vote on Framework 48 in December. We're going to schedule another committee meeting, and I'm sure the PDT is going to meet multiple times, if not Tom's going to feel like it's a one-month meeting for him. Our plan for today is Tom's going to provide a brief Framework 48 overview. Andy's going to provide us an update on the closed area issues in progress. We've got a motion on goals and objectives. We've got a number of issues related to specifications, including motions for the TMDC, the groundfish, the George's Bank yellowtail flounder allocations, and the Southern New England windowpane flounder. We've got probably a dozen or more committee motions specific to Framework 48, and the Groundfish Committee has also made a recommendation for mitigation measures for fishing year 2013. I hope my voice makes it through the day, but I'm going to turn it over to Tom for an overview on Framework 48.
I'll be very brief so we can turn it over to Andy. Obviously, Framework 48 is not ready for a final vote today. We have not completed the impact analyses for just about anything. In part, that's because we're still working on some of the measures, and a couple of the motions that you'll hear today are suggestions to add a few measures to the document, so we're still working on that. As Terry pointed out, the plan for the today is Andy is first going to go over the goals and objectives for the omnibus groundfish closed areas as part of the omnibus habitat amendment. Then he will give an update on the Framework 48 progress by the closed area technical team. Once Andy is done, we will move into the specification issues primarily related to yellowtail flounder and the scallop fishery, but also with respect to windowpane flounder and the scallop fishery. Once we get done with those specification issues, we'll get into the broader Framework 48 questions, and then at the end of the day, I think there's one or maybe two council motions that are suggestions for mitigation measures for next year, which are actually outside of the groundfish plan. Having said that, I'll turn it over to Andy.
Thank you, Tom. I'm going to give a very brief presentation. It's document 12A in your binder. That's different than Tom's presentation, which is document 12B. Also, on goals and objectives, the document from the Groundfish Plan Development Team to the Oversight Committee is document number 6. I'll try and be brief so I can turn it back over to Tom. Okay, when we started this process in late September, the CAT, or the Closed Area Technical Team, was formed in September, and we first identified a need to narrow down some policy goals and objectives and seek approval of the committee and the council on those so we can move ahead in developing some management options for the omnibus amendment. To do this, we conducted a survey of the CAT and the PDT members to rank the importance of closed area functions within the context of current management. So the emphasis on mortality control that existed for those areas was greatly reduced, and some other kind of ecological objectives came to the forefront. We held a meeting, post-survey evaluation, to lead to the recommended goals and objectives that are in this presentation and in the October 5th document. Two goals came forth. They're kind of mom and apple pie kind of thing that you would include in the amendment anyway, to enhance groundfish fishery productivity and to maximize societal net benefits from the groundfish stocks while addressing current management needs. Then there are a series of four objectives, and these goals and objectives were considered after the CAT recommendations by the Groundfish PDT, and there were a couple of clarifications made to those objectives, and it went forward to the Groundfish Committee, which approved these as written. The first one deals with spawning protection, including localized spawning contingents or subpopulations, addresses spawning fidelity and conservation of substocks and prevents extirpation. A lot of this would probably be focused on cod, but it also encompasses other species as well, and we will be looking at those as we develop alternatives for the omnibus. Second objective is to improve protection of critical groundfish habitats. This is somewhat different than the objective that the Habitat PDT and Habitat Committee is focusing on, to protect vulnerable bottom habitat. It's more ecosystem-based, centric, and focused. Third objective is to improve refuge for critical life history stages. If there's, for example, some type of bottleneck in terms of discards or other critical life history stages of various species. And then fourth, to improve access to both the use and non-use benefits arising from closed area management across gear types, fisheries, and groups. So not a primary reason for the closed areas, but a consideration for special management areas, and it could produce specific benefits for fisheries and ocean users. We have held a number, since that time, we've held a number of CAT meetings focused on Framework 48, but we intend on getting back to the omnibus amendment as soon as possible. We have a meeting scheduled for November 28th, which we will touch on developing approaches. We have a conference call scheduled for December 5th to continue that work, and a physical meeting on December 12th to review analyses and evaluate options. So with that, I'll stop and take any questions. Thank you.
Any questions for either Tom or Andy? Anyone in the audience so far? Okay, I guess.
My best.
Oh. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did have just a question. I was just trying to figure out the process for the goals and objectives, and it looks like between the PDT and I guess we call it the CAT team or whatever, it proposed goals and objectives. Did the committee review the goals and objectives and approve them? Is that the stage where we're at, or is this like an in-process thing we're now reporting and the committee will need to consider it?
Mary Beth, I've got a motion, a committee motion, when the chairman's ready.
Anyone else? Terry.
To that point, this committee motion, the Groundfish Committee recommends the council adopt the goals and objectives for design of revised groundfish closed areas as part of the Omnibus Habitat Amendment as outlined by the Groundfish PDT memo of October 5th, 2012, it passed the committee 901.
Committee motion, no second required, discussion. Seeing none on the council, any comments from the audience? Back to the council. Call the question. All those in favor, so indicate. Sixteen in favor, opposed, abstention, one. 16-01, the motion carries. Terry.
Andy's going to continue with a brief report on the CAT progress on Framework 48 sector access.
Thank you very much. Since during October and late September and October, the CAT has worked very hard on assembling data analyses and information relevant to the sector exemption alternative in Framework 48. We have conducted a comparative analysis of various areas relevant to that alternative, including the sector exemption areas, EFH closure areas, which would remain closed to bottom-tending mobile gears and all groundfish gears when they overlap with year-round groundfish closed areas, and compared that to open fishing areas including the consideration of a 10 nautical mile boundary, which was excluded due to the effects of intensified fishing effort on the stocks and fish that occur in those areas. We've looked at biological characteristics arising from the trawl survey data, including length, age, individual weight, maturity, stomach weight, and combinations of those, average catch per unit effort measured by stratified mean biomass by species, proportion of swept area biomass exposed to fishing, in other words, how much of the stock is estimated to occur within the sector exemption areas. We have assembled and reviewed a rather comprehensive literature and research on closed area effects, including morphometrics, biomass abundance per toe, before, after closed and outside analysis, and effects on stock rebuilding. We've invited the group that led by Lisa Kerr, actually Steve Cadron, gave a presentation to the CAT, and also Graham Sherwood has also given a presentation to the CAT on both the research. We've analyzed fishery data, including comparative analysis of observed catch, comparing standard trawl catches, separator trawl catches, gill nets and hook gears. We've summarized the relevant issues involved with various permitting and regulations and fishing activity by sector and enrolled vessels. We've done an analysis of comparative habitat effects, including effects on essential fish habitat and vulnerable benthic habitat as measured by the SASE model. We've evaluated protected species and looked at economic and social impacts, including groundfish revenue, non-groundfish target species, which include species like monkfish and skates, incidental catch, and potential changes in fishing costs arising from high catch per unit effort and less fishing time. Much of the analysis, but not all of it, is qualitative in nature. However, quite a bit of quantitative analysis has been done. In terms of overall things that we see forthcoming, the sector exemption areas is option 2 in your Framework 48 document. We would expect that to reduce biological differences between presently fished and non-fished areas. It should increase the opportunity to fish, in other words, higher revenue for under-harvested species, particularly choke species, if the catches are lower in the sector exemption areas than in currently open areas, and the potential reduced cost if catch rates for target species are higher in the sector exemption areas than currently open areas. For the no-action status quo, which is option 1, your document, it's almost the reverse of that, except that no-action would retain or build on biological differences between fish and non-fish areas. It might, compared with the option 2, limit opportunity to fish for under-harvested species, and the cost would be higher than in option 2 if the catch rates are lower than in currently open areas than in the proposed sector exemption areas. So that's about where we're at. We have a meeting on November 28th to finalize our analysis and reach final conclusions and include that information in the Framework 48 document that the Groundfish PDT and the Groundfish Oversight Committee and the Council will see in subsequent meetings here in December. Thank you.
Terry.
Yep. One of the mitigation measures the Groundfish Committee has included in Framework 48 is consideration of sector exemption requests for the groundfish closed areas. And at the recent NRCC meeting and committee meeting, NERO's proposed consideration to EFPs as an alternative measure. And from what I understand, you folks are leading the other way from this right now. I'm wondering if you could provide the council an update so we can all catch up to speed.
Mr. Chair and Terry, let me make a few remarks and then turn it over to George. The regional office has been looking at opening up groundfish mortality areas, and I want to say what our goal is because it's important to keep that in mind. The idea behind opening up groundfish mortality areas is to increase access to reasonably healthy groundfish stocks, but to do that in a responsible and well-thought-out way. We know these areas have been closed for almost 2 decades, and so we do want to think this through. We're aware that of the potential harm that can be done in opening these areas up. So George and his team, which includes Mike Ruccio, is here, and Sue Murphy. Sue, can you stand up so people can see who you are as well? Thank you. So we haven't got all this figured out, so that's why I wanted Sue and Mike and George to be identified. So people in the audience who have ideas on how best to do that can, you know, we're interested in your ideas today, tomorrow, the next day. We're interested in your ideas on the best way to do that. So the goal is how to make available reasonably healthy groundfish stocks. We thought, because what was originally on the table is all the mortality areas, and that's kind of what we started thinking about. And it was started, as I'm sure many people thought about, you know, Wild West atmosphere, all the areas, no rules, go get the stocks. And then we started thinking about what are the problems with that. And we started also getting a lot of comments that, that's not the smartest way to go about doing it. And we started to narrow our focus for various reasons and started to home in primarily on haddock and primarily on closed area 1 and closed area 2 and thinking about what rules would accomplish the goal, what gear, what times of year would get us the goal of access to healthy stocks in ways that are environmentally responsible and that do no harm and that can get access to people as quickly as possible so that it's done in a predictable way where the analysis required is narrow and therefore doesn't take a huge amount of time. That's what we're trying to do. We also started to get a lot of feedback from people that opening up areas in the Western Gulf of Maine would not be desired, that the do no harm clause would be violated. People really started to object. I must have gotten, I don't know, 25 or 30 emails just in the last 24 hours that's not a good idea. So this is a dynamic process. So your comments are of interest to us right now, and that's why we're interested from members of the council, from members in the audience, how to do it. As Terry has said, we have thought about the best way to try and define the rules. what gear, what time, what's the best way to do it. We've looked at exempted fishing permit as a way to do it. We've looked at sector exemption as a way to do it. We have gone back and forth. Frankly, I'm not sure which way we're leaning right now. That's why the safest thing for me to do is turn it over to George. George, where are we today?
Today, well, it is true that at the Groundfish Committee meeting, I guess it was last week, Monday, we came forward to kind of lay out our thinking that doing these exemptions through an exempted fishing permits might be the best way to go. Frankly, we're thinking out loud with you as we're going through this. This is not something that we normally have done, but given the importance of this, and we want to get it right, so we are basically thinking out loud in front of you. We got a lot of negative comments, frankly, about the EFP approach, and we did have some concerns ourselves about exactly how that would be administered. We haven't ruled that out, but after further consideration, I think we are leaning more towards the sector exemption approach again, which would require the council to give us that authority in Framework 48. And then, as John mentioned, we would look at some fairly focused approach that we could analyze in time to get it in place on or near May 1. We would not put it in the same rulemaking as the sector operations plans. It would be parallel, a separate action. In case we cannot make the May 1 time frame. But we think it would accomplish many of the same objectives we were trying to get at with the EFH approach, but give more flexibility to the sectors to decide who's going to fish, where they're going to fish, how they're going to fish, rather than trying to for us to decide through issuance of EFPs what vessels would get them and what specific restrictions would be on them. So that's basically where we are, leaning towards back towards the sector approach through rulemaking with an environmental assessment that would be hopefully effective on or near May 1. I should also mention we're also looking at trying to get a high level of monitoring on those trips because they have been closed for a long time, and there's not a lot of information even from our surveys in those closed areas as to exactly what the resource abundance and distribution is. So we would do this cautiously, but as flexible as we can. And again, this is an interim measure that we would have in place while the council's completing its omnibus amendment, which would then overwrite whatever we'd be doing through this rulemaking. So I think that covers where we are. Thank you.
Council, any questions, comments? Doug?
Yeah, there's a question for Andy. In your analysis that you're doing here, are you looking at it on an area-by-area basis so that we'd have this analysis to say this is what the data says about that you've collected in for closed Area 1 and then have something for the Western Gulf of Maine closure, or is it a cumulative impacts if we were to open up all of them?
We are looking at the analyses on an area-by-area basis to the extent that we can. We're somewhat hampered by the amount of data that's available within rather small areas. And so in some ways we're looking at it area by area basis, but in other ways we're looking at it a little more broad scale too. And some of that broad scale might be Gulf of Maine versus the three Georges Bank areas. So that's how we're looking at it.
David Pierce.
Yeah, Andy, I've got a question about CAT work, CAT analysis in the context of a concern that's been raised a number of times by the Recreational Advisory Panel. I'll reference the document number 3 in our binder, groundfish binder, where we see the specific concerns expressed by the advisory panel about impacts of opening the closed areas to commercial fishing effort on the recreational fishery. Questions about impact on availability of fish after the commercial fishery goes in. Legitimate concern expressed by the recreational fishery. In your presentation, you indicated that the CAT is looking at economic and social impacts, specific groundfish revenue. Is the CAT going to be doing any analyses that would help us address the concerns, the issues raised by the recreational advisory panel about the impact of commercial effort on the recreational fishing industry? And if the CAT is not going to do that, related question, who is going to do that?
Yes, thank you. I have tasked Dr. Gorette De Piper on the CAT to evaluate the effects. The primary data source for that is the vessel trip report data. To the extent that they're accurate and other information that we can pull together. I will have that on the agenda for the November 28th meeting, and it will be in the final analysis.
Terry Alexander.
This question for Andy, I guess. Now, I was looking at some of the analysis on the different research projects that have gone on in the Gulf of Maine closed areas, for instance, and we're talking about putting up a little sliver on the eastern edge of the western Gulf of Maine closure, and Cassius, the same thing, a good chunk of Cassius closure, but both of seemed like most of the testing that was done there was done in the shoal water. How do you analyze something that you really don't have any information on in the deep water habitats out there?
Yeah, we're working with various sorts of information, including the fishery data and where fishing occurs through that, the observed fishing activity. We're working with the survey data, which is in that area conducted in the spring and the fall, but is limited to some extent in terms of seasonality. It doesn't sample, obviously, during the summertime. And we're looking at various research studies that have occurred. The problem with the research studies is that they're usually a finite time period and look at a specific site. So to the extent that we can address those, we are. There are some issues in terms of the depth of where sampling occurs that we need to take into account. I can't be more specific about that, but it is an issue in terms of depth does play a factor.
But I think that's where a lot of the negative comments are coming from. That, you know, all the research that has been done have been done in the shoal water, and we're not even comparing apples to apples, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know how to calm people's fears on those areas opening up when the analysis that you have to put forward is a lot of what research has been done in the past in the shoal of water. So just my comment on it.
Matt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to follow up on Terry's comment, I'm a little concerned about where this conversation is going. We seem to have gone right over the question as to whether or not we should do this and skipped right over to how we're going to do it, what different operations, what procedural innovations we're going to develop to do it. I think we need to have, given what Terry has just pointed out and given the level of uncertainty and the potential magnitude, we need to slow down and make sure that if we're going to do this, we're not cutting our own throats. And going through the committee reports and the advisory panel reports, there's a lot of people in the fishing community right now who are concerned about opening these areas at all. And the fact that we're taking Western Gulf of Maine, that's coming off the consideration table, and just looking at or focusing largely on Closed Area 1 and Closed Area 2, that is going to have a disproportionate benefit if we open it to various, for different ports and different segments of the fleet. We need to slow down.
we need to make sure that what we have left is going to be left intact to have a fishery in 15 or 20 years. And I think once we have solid, good analysis put forward, then, and I'm not knocking the work that you're doing in the CAT. I'm impressed by it. It's a lot of work to do in a very short amount of time. But we need to make sure we know what we're doing before we start talking about how to move forward. I think we're going too fast. I think the fishing community is concerned about how fast we're going. And frankly, those are my fears. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, I have Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the approach of differentiating between these areas. I think both those who have real concerns about access to these areas and those who want to get into them bundle them maybe inappropriately, that a closed area isn't necessarily a closed area and they're all not providing the same benefits and expanded access isn't resulting in the same level of risk. So I don't disagree with that. I think they do need to be analyzed, and we need to start talking about them individually as opposed to as a package. I guess my question is one, and this is the second time I've heard this, that we would instantly go to closed area one, closed area two, more or less only, and that this is largely a measure to get access to Georgia's Bank haddock. I think there are other healthy stocks that groundfish sectors are targeting. And in my mind, you know, looking at what we have in front of us in terms of the lightship area, you know, I think the lightship opening or expanding access to the lightship area shouldn't be discounted. There are things that you can go in there and catch. It doesn't light up. There are very minimal habitat impacts. And I just don't want to rush to closed area one, closed area two. I think Matt brings up a good point that certainly would provide additional access to haddock, but this isn't all about Georgia's Bank haddock, and I think we can expand our definition of what a positive outcome would be for the fishery in terms of additional revenue that we can do responsibly. So I guess my point is just that I think some other areas could be considered and that we shouldn't just be focused on Georgia's Bank haddock.
Laura.
Frank and I are sharing today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Blow, thank you very much for your comments on the approach and the rationale for why we're thinking about opening these areas. One thing I just wanted to take issue with is the thought that it's all areas, Wild West, no rules. Let's be very conscious of the fact that we have a very strong rule system in place. If anyone's looked at a plan that a fishing captain has to follow before he's allowed to go to sea, would tell you that it would not be the wild, wild west, that we have very conservative catch limits in place. And to Tom's point, we should be looking at additional areas where things like redfish and pollock, I know that those are vital items as a processor that we're trying to push onto menus across the country. So I would definitely encourage looking at a broader area and not just considering haddock. And the final thing I'd like to say is it does concern me that, especially listening to some of the comments that George made, that those that are well-funded and have deep pockets for lawyers are able to convince through email campaigns and other strategies like threatening to tie boats to the dock, to bully the council and the service. I think that's unconscionable. And the fishermen are in the fight for their lives, and we need to be really careful that we're listening to what they're saying as much as we are to well-funded groups that have a much better and more savvy media campaign than our fishermen are able to have. Thank you.
George.
To that point, I understand what you're saying, but the fact is, I would say the great majority of the people who have come to us with comments have been fishermen, both recreational and commercial, not deep pocket people.
Mary Beth.
And to sort of follow up on George's comments there, I have seen a number of concerns raised by the recreational community, but it does, at the same time, it does concern me to hear some references to taking, the Western Gulf of Maine closure off the table. I wasn't aware that that was a decision that had been made at all. and I'm sure that you will weigh all of the considerations in, I guess, now the accepted approach, which is the exemption approach in this framework. But I do have to wonder if people are somewhat confused about the Western Gulf of Maine closure. The majority of that closure, is, if you allowed exemptions in that area, does not give free access to the groundfish fishery. Most of that area is overlapped by essential fish habitat closure, and that's not going to be open. It is just a small area within the Western Gulf Gulf of Maine mortality closure that would be available to the fishery. So, you know, I understand the concerns that have been raised, but I do wonder if people really understand what we are talking about.
I have John Bullard and PK.
Just wanted to ask Tom, as you talk about the light ship area, what stocks do you have in mind?
I think the fixed gear sector, I know some other sectors could look at opportunities to target monkfish and skates as they move up from the southern New England area. And, you know, I think they could do that with, as they already have, effectively no groundfish bycatch. So that would be important, and those are, you know, those fleets, as we talked about, I think, yesterday, those fleets are overlapping significantly. So I think that would be a real benefit, especially in the lightship area.
PK.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to comment. I'd like to echo what Mary Beth had said. I didn't realize that we were going to be limited to closed area 1 and 2 today. I thought everything was on the table, and that's what we are here to discuss. So that's my comment. My question would be to John or George. You talked about if an area was opened up, you would want a higher observer coverage in those areas. How do you see, how do you foresee going through that to get that through an exempted fisheries permit or through the sector ops plan?
First of all, I think everybody should understand that we were not saying that we have made the final decision on any of these areas. This is what our thinking is right now. So part of what we're trying to do is get input from you as to what you think of that. As far as the monitoring goes, we haven't taken that very far yet. We still have to think through how that would occur, what level it would be, how it would be funded, where those resources would come from. So we're not prepared to give you that answer yet, but we know it's an issue.
Doug Grout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for another bite of the apple. I wanted to ask another question that came to mind as some of the discussion here. And it has to do with the economic and social impacts analysis that you all are providing for us for, are going to be providing for us for Framework 48. And is this going to be broken down? Is this just going to be a general economic impact for the whole fleet, or are you going to have it broken down by vessel size or gear type or state? Is that something that's going to come forward? Because in addition, while I look to make my decisions on this Framework 48, I'm going to be looking at the overall benefit to the entire groundfish industry. But clearly, as a state director, I'm going to want to be looking at what the impact is on the specific parts of that fleet that operate out of New Hampshire here. So I was wondering how detailed the analysis, particularly the economic and social impacts, are going to be.
Well, we can examine the types of vessels that fish in proximity to areas that are likely to benefit from increased access. And to the extent that we can quantify that, we will. Some of that's going to require some qualitative analysis, but I do appreciate you bringing the question to the forefront so I can make sure that's in the analysis. Thank you.
Terry Alexander. Dave Gahill.
Thank you. My first question is to either Tom or Andy. Is there a chart available on our website that shows the areas that are proposed to be possibly opened?
Yes, there is. It's in the Framework 48 document. Option 2 has the chart, and if I remember the figure right, it shows some crosshatch areas in all the closed areas, which are the areas that are being considered to be opened.
Okay. The reason I'm asking this is to call the public's attention to these charts, because there are a number of misstatements out there about areas that are proposed to be open. I read one article that said people would be towing through the kelp forests on Cash's Ledge. That's not true. And I think the public should go and, you know, look at these charts and see the areas that are proposed to be open. That's number one. Second of all, as an individual, I have no dog in this fight. All the areas that are proposed to be open, on my boat and myself, are not going to any of them. So I think I can speak a little bit as a neutral party here. There's no benefit to me in this one way or the other. There's no negative consequence either, in my opinion. Third, I'd like to say that I support the approach that's currently today been presented by the service. I think that's an improvement over the experimental fishing process. I think that's the proper way to go. I don't think we should have winners and losers by sector or by gear type or anything else in this. For people that want to go there, it should be, open on an equal basis to everyone. And last, I'd like to recommend a way to solve this issue of increased observer coverage for trips that may go to these newly opened areas, and that is to add a declaration to the VMS screen, or to the pre-trip notification system. It doesn't even have to be to the VMS. You don't have to change the VMS. To the pre-trip notification system, that you declare into the areas that you propose to fish in. So, for example, you propose to fish in the newly opened closed area 1 and closed area 2, as an example, or you propose to fish in the part of the Western Gulf of Maine closure or the Cache's closure that are open. And then assign observer coverage based on that declaration. And if you have not declared an intent to fish into those areas, you are still not allowed to fish in them. And that would be a way to guarantee that you get the observer coverage that everybody seems to desire for those trips. It'll also make people think in advance whether or not this is the areas they wish to fish in and what species they wish to target. I think that's a reasonable and viable way forward. It doesn't cost any, I don't believe it's going to cost any money on the part of the service to change a pre-declaration screen, pre-trip notification screen. And I do think, as an individual, that I would like, as a council member and a fisherman, to have more knowledge of what occurs when people fish in these newly opened areas. I do think the surveys have probably not covered them to the degree that they should have been covered for the time that they've been closed, and the only way to find out what's really going on in those areas is to send people out there that know how to catch something. So that would be a suggestion of a way forward to solve the issue of the observer coverage, and that's all I have to say at this time.
Anyone else on the council? PK.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to the agency, to George or John, do you have an idea of what, like, percentage of coverage you would like to see? I mean, would you like to see 100% coverage if it opened up? I like Dave's idea, if you had to declare into that area, what kind of coverage are you looking for?
Well, as I said, we're still looking. I mean, sure, 100% would be great, but it may not be practical. So, probably 50% or more, but that's just off the top of my head. Enough so that we're confident that we know what's happening, so that if anything is going wrong, we can adjust to it, and enough so that we can get good information about what actually is there and where it is, and some biological sampling, hopefully, on spawning and so forth, something that will be useful to all of us in the future.
Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for you, Andy. You talked about the economic analysis and the economic impact upon the groundfish fishery in your analyses, and I'm looking forward to seeing the final results out of that. Are you considering the potential impact of this access to other fisheries, in particular to the scallop fishery? There's a paper by Tiang Chen, Stokesberry's Rothschild, and others from 2009 that shows that closed area 2 is a very good and strong dispersal of scallop larvae outside that area. And the question I have is your committee going to look at potential impacts of ground fishing gear in that area upon the possible larval recruitment for the scallop industry itself? Thank you.
Some information is not readily available in terms of recruitment processes. However, long-term consequences is an issue that the CAT members are aware of and will probably comment on in the final analysis. We are, however, focused only on access to the areas by vessels in sector programs, not access to the areas by the scallop fleet for Framework 48. As we move to the omnibus amendment, I see another set of factors coming into play, as you suggest.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we need to I like a lot of what I'm hearing here, but I think we need to look at a little reality and a little history. First of all, this analysis of groundfish areas began as a means of helping along the habitat amendment. It was recognized, and this goes back 2 years, that if we were to get the right areas closed, the proper area closed for habitat protection under the omnibus amendment, that we would wind up with a de facto increase in the bottom which was closed to the industry. That was the primary rationale at the time. And it was not the intent of the Habitat Committee at that time to expand this to a consideration of all groundfish areas. Not that we didn't want to do that, but it was outside of our purview at that time. Our purview was specifically to generate the political ability to change the habitat areas, get rid of areas that were not really doing the job, and put in areas that would. Now, with that in mind, we did at that time decide to go ahead with an analysis of groundfish closed areas, and it was decided that it would be efficacious to expand that to all of the groundfish areas. That was more than 2 years ago now. And it was expected at that time that such an analysis, even on that limited basis, would add a year or more to the overall time frame of the Habitat Amendment. And it just strikes me that now, due to the crisis, which was not anticipated at that time, the crisis in the ground fishery, they were trying to expand that and at the same time do it on the cheap and on the fly. And I agree, Tom is quite right, if we're going to do it that way, if we're going to make this a major groundfish change, that we should be adding the Nantucket Lightship closed area. And we should be looking in detail at the Western Gulf of Maine. But then I look at this very well-done groundfish goals and objectives methodology, and I get over to page 5 where there's factors analyzed. And we're talking about biological characteristics and fishery analysis, and having been involved with that kind of work, to think that we're going to get that done in 3 months is just ludicrous. It's not going to happen. So I think that Matt is right, that as a matter of doing this right and not making another major mistake in how we manage not just habitat but manage the ground fishery, that this isn't going to be done on the cheap and on the fly. So where does that leave us? I don't know. I like what the RA says about the approach that's being used. by the agency. But as I said, I very much like what was presented here today. But in just looking it over and just giving it the smile test, I don't see this being done in any 2 or 3 months. This is a bigger analysis. And so I don't have an answer for that, but I just wanted to interject that little bit of reality. Thank you.
Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm a little concerned or a little confused about what the council's next steps are. Last week we heard from the agency that the exemption process was unlikely to be able to, you know, move forward and be approved, and so the agency suggested, proposed formally, I think at NRCC as well, that we go with an EFP approach. And that was less than 10 days ago, and now it seems as though we've reversed course again. We're putting together an alternative that it sounds like from John's comments is going to be whittled after the fact. I just don't understand how, in response to George's comments of sort of thinking out loud about this, how the council participates in that thought process and in that discussion. As far as I can see, we have the two options that have been discussed in the last week were the EFPs, which I don't believe require any council action, and the exemption, which apparently we're moving forward with, but it seems like two separate conversations are occurring in parallel, and I'm not sure how the council weighs in on this.
George.
Yeah, I don't think it's as complicated as that. Neither approach takes a council action, except if we use the council or the sector exemption approach. We do need in Framework 48. We need you to complete the measure that would give us the ability to exempt access to closed areas. That's basically all we need from you. The analysis of whatever it is we ultimately decide to reopen and under what conditions. That's something we do independently and are starting now. That analysis will be dependent upon exactly how focused the reopenings are. The more focused they are, the quicker we can do it, the faster we can have this in place. We can't put any of these in place until we have Framework 48 completed, because that gives us the authority to do this. So our plan would be to develop the analysis and all the regulations for proposed and final rules and get them ready to go when Framework 48 is complete or as close to it as possible. The other thing the council needs to do is to continue working on the omnibus amendment, which will take all of this away. This is just a stopgap thing, and our major objective, as John said, is not to mess things up, frankly. We don't want to do something that we're going to regret and allow too much effort into the wrong places or something like that, and then spend the next 5 or 10 years saying that was a really dumb thing we did.
If I could, George, just if I heard you correctly, I'm thinking that Andy doesn't need to be spending his time with the CAT analyzing the things for Framework 48, which would come under the sector exemption request, but he could be using all of this time to focus the efforts on moving the omnibus habitat amendment forward. And did I hear that correctly?
My expert is saying no. We still do need that analysis in Framework 48. May I add one thing to what I said earlier? Our intent would be to work with the sector managers too in this process to find out more specifically what exemptions they would be looking for to help us fine-tune the analysis to get this done faster and better.
And take a couple more comments on this. I see Tom and Matt and Dave.
I just wanted to follow up with that. I actually agree with George. We might be making this too complicated. If the idea is that we're going to analyze this and the service is going to analyze these exemption requests individually, then what we set out to do, I think, was to change a single line in Amendment 16, which was you can't request exemptions to these areas. And we've gone through a complicated process of identifying subsets of those areas. And, you know, we're arguing about that. And the agency and staff are working on how would we do the analysis on this subset of these areas for this 1 year. Maybe the easier thing to do for the council that doesn't diminish the analysis that needs to be done is for the council to simply create an alternative that removes the restriction or prohibition on seeking exemptions to year-round groundfish closed areas. That's what we're here to do, and everything else will fall out. I wonder whether we are making this too complicated.
Tom.
I think we have to recall the history here a little bit. History, a loose term for something that's only been going on about 4 months, I guess. But, you know, the initial idea that was coming forward was just to do exactly that, was just to put in a line in the document that said sectors could request exemptions to the groundfish closed areas. And that led to a concern that that would require an EIS for a bunch of reasons. And so, really, that's where we are. We've just narrowed the areas that we can request access to. I mean, that's really all we're doing is we're just creating an exemption that's we're creating a management action that will allow sectors to request exemption to specific areas and times. And all Andy's group is doing is, in somewhat broad terms, analyzing what the likely impacts of authorizing that exemption request could be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned about some of the procedural novelties, perhaps, that are being developed here. I apologize for perhaps mischaracterizing what I'm hearing, but it seems to me that you know, we need to approve something, and then the regional office will go off and make the decisions, evaluate applications, grant permissions or not. That seems to fly in the face of the function of this council. This council is here, if I can speak constitutionally, if you will, to provide a forum by which important decisions about this fishery, such as accessing closed areas, are made in the open, in a public forum, where all have a right to say. And this motion, this movement, seems to be basically sweeping that into the inside the doors of the regional office, which, you know, John, you and I have worked together, we know each other, I have utmost respect for you and faith in what the regional office will do. But it doesn't have the same transparency that I think the industry deserves. And there will be questions about how are these decisions made? Who gets access? Who doesn't get access? And if that's not done in the open, who knows where that's going to go? And so I'm concerned about that. I'm very concerned about that. And I think we need to think carefully about the precedent we're setting by this, because if it's not this issue, it may be something else. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
George.
I think Gene wants to speak too, but I don't think this is novel, actually. We request from the sectors every year exemptions. We ask them to provide to us whatever exemption request they would like. This has been going on for several years. We analyze what they've requested. We put that out for public comment through a proposed rule, and look at that comment and then respond based on our analyses, our review of the comments, and so forth. This is the same process. In fact, if anything, this is more open, because ordinarily we wouldn't be here today having this discussion with you in public. The council could have done this themselves, and we had that discussion. But in order to get Framework 48 completed, and it's already, as you know, it's a stretch to get this in place on or near May 1 as it is, we offered to the council that we could take this on ourselves and do this analysis to help out. It's not a hide the ball. It was to be helpful, to be expedient, and to provide the industry and the public what they need as quickly as possible. But it's if anything, a more transparent process than most of the sector exemption requests are and have been.
Dave Preble, and then we're going to wrap this.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, if we exercise the change to the exemption clause in A16, as Tom pointed out, in order to obviate the kind of criticism that Matt is coming up with, could we require that that exemptions granted by the agency be reviewed by the council in order to have that kind of transparency? Or would that add a cumbersome next step? I don't have a sense of that yet. And I had a question for George. When you guys do the analysis, is it similar or confluent with the kind of analysis outlined on page 5 and in the top of page 6 of the document that Andy gave us? Is that the kind of thing that you would be doing? The two panels on page 5 and the panel at the top of page 6.
Well, I don't think I can specifically answer your last question. It will be an environmental assessment, an EA, similar to what we always do. We were looking at the, once we know what the bounds of the scope of the exemptions would be, then we look at the impacts on the human environment. And that includes everything from protected resources to economics to everything, as we always do. But as I said, the more focused we are, the easier it is to do that analysis well, and the more quickly we can do it, because we don't have to take into account as many different factors and as many different times and areas and so on as we would if we just did everything. And that's partly why we want to be focused, so we can get this done.
Okay. Thank you, George. John, did you have something?
Just a point of clarification. George said this will all go away once the omnibus amendment passes. Is there an estimated time of arrival for the omnibus amendment?
That's not really a question for me. That's a council action, so I'll defer to someone else to answer that.
Tom?
Yeah, I'd like to clarify a couple comments that have been made. There's been talk that this is a one-year thing, and there's talk that it'll go away when the Omnibus Habitat Amendment is adopted. The first is that as the measure is currently written in the document, it's not a one-year thing. It just says that sectors can request exemptions into these areas. And whether or not the Omnibus Habitat Amendment will modify that is, at this point, an open question, because we don't know what the Omnibus Habitat Amendment is going to do with those closed areas.
Okay. I want to say thank you to the regional office for doing some open thinking with us. I think this has been a good discussion. I think you obviously have gotten some feedback on what your thoughts are and ways to proceed with this. I have received a request to get some comments from Mayor Mitchell, and I'm going to ask him if he would like to make those at this point in time.
Good morning, everyone. I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Administrator Bullard. Good morning, members. I have a letter to read into the record today, and just to preview it and the frame where it's coming from, let me just mention a couple of things. Over the course of the summer, we had a couple of decisions concerning Yellowtail Quota 1 out of the TMGC, which set the American allocation at, if I remember correctly, 215 metric tons. And then another from the SSC, which is appointed by this body, at 1,150 metric tons and would make Yellowtail, would stop having Yellowtail be a directed fishery. And what prompted me to come today is concerns the tension between these two decisions and at least some rumblings to the extent that some people feel that they have to go with the TMGC's recommendation as opposed to the SSC. So I have a letter that I want to address that directly. We'll have that distributed to you at the break. But let me read the letter, and then I'll add one other comment. As mayor of New Bedford, Massachusetts, I write to express my concern about the proposed U.S. Georges Bank Yellowtail flounder quota of 215 metric tons for the 2013 fishing year and urge you instead to adopt the SSC's recommendation that the total acceptable biological catch be set at 1,150 metric tons with the removal of that fishery as a directed fishery. If you believe that the U.S.-Canada resource sharing understanding precludes you from adopting the SSC's recommendation for whatever reason, I ask that you request that the U.S. representatives to the U.S.-Canada Steering Committee approach Canada in order for them to reconsider that decision for FY13. As you know, Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder is highly important to the Port of New Bedford, which was recently named the nation's highest-grossing fishing port for the 12th year in a row. New Bedford's yearly groundfish landings are worth approximately $20 million, and the scallop industry, for which yellowtail is essential bycatch, brings in approximately $400 million in direct annual revenue to the port. Taking into account the two fisheries' ancillary business impacts, they generate nearly $1.3 billion in annual economic activity in the greater New Bedford area. Based on the Transboundary Resource Assessment Committee's Yellowtail Assessment, the TMGC recommended that a total of 500 metric tons of yellowtail flounder for the 2013 fishing year. This 500 metric ton quota is to be split between the United States and Canada, of course, resulting in allocations of 215 and 280 metric tons, respectively, between the U.S. and Canada, the U.S. getting the smaller share. This would be a 57% reduction from 2012, when the quota was 1,150 metric tons, a staggering 81% reduction from 2011, when the total was 2,650 metric tons. A reduction of this magnitude would cause hundreds, if not thousands, of New Bedford jobs to disappear and would trigger severe economic and social dislocation. I do not mean to overstate this at all. This is a very real possibility. Such devastating consequences would be difficult to accept if the science were certain, but they are impossible to accept given the widespread lack of confidence and the underlying track assessment and the fact that the track did not follow its own protocols in formulating its catch recommendations. It is my understanding that the track's accepted benchmark methods would support catch limits for the 2013 fishing year of 800 metric tons to 3,000 metric tons to avoid overfishing, and of 1,700 to 1,800 metric tons to allow rebuilding. These ranges are substantially higher than the 500 metric tons that the track established earlier this summer. Because the track's benchmark methods demonstrated retrospective patterns, however, the track implemented so-called fixes that assumed that recent catch had been five times higher than the reported catch, or that the natural mortality abruptly increased by a factor of five in 2005. There was some tweaking going on here. These methods used in the 2012 track assessment were exploratory in nature and have not been vetted through the track's own benchmark review process. And the track report itself acknowledges that these so-called fixes to the retrospective pattern cannot, quote, be explained by biology or fishery practices, close quote. Nonetheless, the track ultimately relied on these fixes to develop its recommendation that the 2013 quota be set as low as 500 metric tons. In short, the proposed quota of 500 metric tons would inflict broad, irreparable damage on the fishing industry based on what one could hardly call the best available science. At its August 24, 2000 meeting, the SSC acknowledged both the uncertainty in the track assessment and the catastrophic human consequences that would unquestionably flow from a low yellowtail quota. As a result, the SSC ultimately included in its report a recommendation that the 2013 yellowtail quota remain at 1,150 metric tons, but that the fishery be converted to bycatch only. The SSC's rationale was that if the actual catch exceeded 500 metric tons when there was no directed fishery and measures were taken to reduce bycatch as much as possible, quote, it would be de facto evidence that the uncertainty in the stock assessment is greater than described by the sensitivity analyses conducted by the TRAC. I strongly urge you to adopt the SSC's recommendation. This remains an open question that I understand might not be settled at this meeting, but may be addressed at the December meeting. Maintaining a quota of 1,150 metric tons for the 2013 fishing year would prevent the tremendous human suffering that would result assuredly from a 215 metric ton quota, while giving the U.S. and Canadian scientists time to attempt to resolve the uncertainty in the yellowtail assessment. I can attest that the Massachusetts scientists stand ready to improve the assessment. Among other steps, the Massachusetts Marine Fisheries Institute has proposed both an end-to-end stock assessment review and a cooperative yellowtail research survey. If you believe, however, that the United States must renegotiate with Canada in order to recommend a 2013 yellowtail quota that exceeds the TRAC's 500 metric ton quota, I ask that you move, that this council move, to request that the U.S. representatives to the steering committee approach Canada about reconsidering the 2013 quota. As I understand it, at this point, the council is not going back on the SSC's recommendation. But again, I emphasize if you actually believe that you need to, then we'll have to have submit Canada to reconsider. While there might not be any scientific certainty about the current status of Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder, there is certainty that the TRAC did not follow its own protocols in developing its yellowtail quota recommendation and that its fixes to the yellowtail assessment are not scientifically defensible. Given the equally certain ruinous consequences of a 500 metric ton quota, the only responsible course of action is to discuss with Canada the possibility of increasing the quota while the science is being reviewed in a rigorous manner. Let me just add a couple of things. None of this is to suggest that we not honor the treaty with Canada. None of this is to suggest that comity with Canada on matters of fishing policy isn't an important national policy goal at all. It is to recognize that this and what I'm hoping to invite here is a recognition that the scientists that you appointed to the SSC came up with a very different determination from the TRAC, and that their determination is something with which this council should have far more confidence than the TRAC's tinkering on the margins to address retrospective patterns that they really can't explain at all, even with the best available science. So I submit all of this to you. These are important matters. This is, you know, from my standpoint, and I know you appreciate this, these aren't academic questions. These are real people's lives. These are people who, again, will go out of business and stay out of business just because the nature of the fishing industry's barriers to entry. When fishermen go out of business, they tend not to come back, and that's what we're trying to avoid here. And I appreciate your consideration in these weighty and complex matters because they are vitally important to my city. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We will be discussing this issue later on today as part of the groundfish agenda. You're welcome to stay if you'd like, but I know you've got a very busy schedule.
Great. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
I'm going to turn it over to Terry Starkwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to reiterate your thanks to John and George for the open dialogue and for sharing your thoughts. Just to put on the record that the sector exemption closed area access measure will continue to go forward in Framework 48. Next issue for us to discuss are the Framework 48 specs. Tom's got a presentation, then we need several decisions.
Good morning. You've got a presentation in your binder. There are a few additional slides that have been added, so we'll provide copies of that. I'd also like to point out that there's a document in your binder that was distributed, I believe, this morning. It's document number 13, which includes some revisions to the ACL specifications, and you may want to have that handy because that will come up during the discussion on the Georges Bank yellowtail flounder allocations, which is what I'm going to go into first. I'm going to take a little bit of time and go over something that I went over at the committee. The reality is that there's a number of interrelated decisions that have to be made when evaluating how much yellowtail flounder to allocate to the scallop fishery. There's the Georges Bank yellowtail flounder, ABC, which is determined in part or is, considers also the recommendations of the TMGC and the SSC. There's the allocation method that the council decides to choose, which is a measure in Framework 48. And there are the scallop 24 management alternatives, which the council will make decisions on tomorrow, not today. The goal here is to try and get done with at least the yellowtail flounder ABC and yellowtail flounder allocation method today, as well as later in the morning or afternoon, the southern New England mid-Atlantic yellowtail flounder allocation to the scallop fishery. And assuming we have time, also the southern New England mid-Atlantic windowpane flounder allocation to the scallop fishery. And the reason for that is because that will facilitate completion of scallop framework 24, which you will vote on tomorrow, so that ideally the scallop management program will begin on March 1st. There's another additional decision that may bear on some of this that you will make tomorrow, which relates to the Georges Bank access area timing. I'm not really going to go into that in my presentation today. Deirdre will include slides in her presentation tomorrow that summarizes the PDT's comments that were provided to the Groundfish Committee on that issue. There's at least a couple ways, at least two, maybe three or four ways to consider how to make these decisions. The council could select the ABC for Georges Yellowtail first, then the allocation method, and then decide the scallop alternative, which chronologically is kind of how today and tomorrow are set up. This approach, in essence, recognizes that the allocation method is kind of a programmatic choice and should be made with what you think is going to work for managing the fishery in the future without really referring to the specific allocations for this year. A second approach, of course, is that you change the order slightly and you think about this in the context of, well, we'll pick the ABC, then we'll pick the scallop alternative, and then we'll pick the allocation method that lines up best with the scallop management alternative. This is kind of an approach that recognizes that this year may be unusual due to the low Georges Bank yellowtail quotas, and so the allocation be selected after we know what the scallop fishery is expected to catch. Now, this second approach is not how today's meeting is set up, but it is still an alternative. You could also argue, and I don't have a little flowchart up here, that you should make the yellowtail decisions and the scallop management alternative decisions independently of each other, that the scallop management alternative decision should be made primarily with what's best in mind for the scallop fishery, and then, you know, the scallop fishery will have to live with whatever yellowtail allocation they get. No matter how you look at these, I think you've got to recognize that it's impossible to ignore that when you want us to analyze the impacts, all of these things interact and have an influence on what the impacts are going to be. And so let's talk about that a little. This is going to look familiar to those of you on the Groundfish Committee. So this gets complicated really fast. You start out and with the ABC, and you've got two choices for the ABC. You know, I don't think anybody's really talking about the 200 metric ton recommendation of the SSC. You've got these two. And in Framework 48, we've really got three ways to allocate that. We've got the no action alternative, we've got a fixed percentage alternative, and we've got what I've listed here, the 90% estimate alternative, where we calculate the estimated scallop catch and then allocate them 90% of what we think they're going to catch. I want to make clear that no action doesn't mean there's no allocation. It just means that the council doesn't specify a specific way we're going to do this all the time. And we would continue to do what we did in Framework 44, which is every time we make specs, we look at what's going on and we decide on a number. And, you know, that the way we decide on that number could change from time to time. So then tomorrow, you got a number of scallop alternatives that will be considered. Now, I've got five up here. There's been some changes made by the scallop committee. The reality may be that alternative four, I'm not sure, is still an alternative on the books for consideration tomorrow or not. But anyways, when we worked on this, we knew that there were likely five scallop management alternatives that were going to go forward. Now, the reality is that I think the scallop committee is going to recommend alternative two. And the only other alternative that's received any real serious discussion that I understand is alternative four. So you plug all these together, and this is what you get, all right? So it turns out that there's 30 possible scenarios you want us to analyze for impacts, and this doesn't really tell the whole story because we don't know yet what the cod quotas are going to be for next year, neither Gulf of Maine cod or Georges Bank cod. So if you look in Framework 48, we have a range, a very broad range, with a very high value and a very low value. And so you could take these 30 and multiply by 4 and tell you there's really 120 scenarios you're asking us to look at. I'm not really going to show those results because we didn't really do it that way. But you have to keep in mind that the cod stocks really drive fishing activity for groundfish and have a huge effect on what the economic impacts are in the groundfish fishery. So in order to try and simplify things a little bit, we kind of don't look at the no-action alternatives, so that gets rid of 10 choices for us. The no-action alternative is really captured by the other approaches. It's unlikely that we would pick a quota that doesn't fall between the ranges of the other approaches. If you focus on the most likely scallop management alternatives, it doesn't show up too well on the screen, but that narrows it down a little bit because you're only really looking at alternative 2 and 4. So now we're down to about 8 different choices. If we focus on the TMGC recommendation of 500 metric tons, then it gets narrowed down even a little bit more, and it starts to look a little better, at least in terms of trying to manageably understand what might happen. That doesn't necessarily look good in terms of the results. So if you start out and you consider these two approaches that are being considered in the document, the fixed approach, and the fixed approach actually has two percentages, an 8 and a 16% approach, and the 90% approach. If you just look at these from a programmatic viewpoint, you know, here's just some rough comparisons between the two approaches. An advantage to the fixed approach is it's easy. You've got a number, you get an ABC, and you can calculate the ACLs very quickly. It doesn't change over time. It's a defined amount. Once you know the ABC, everybody knows pretty early in the process what the allocation is going to be. Some of the cons of the fixed approach is that it ignores that there's annual variation in the two fisheries. A big part of that variation is in the scallop fishery. When we're talking Georges Bank yellowtail flounder, their catch of that stock differs quite a bit depending on whether they're allowed access to closed area 2 or not. So if you have a fixed percentage, you're essentially ignoring that year-to-year variation. As written in the document, the fixed approach does not get adjusted automatically. Perhaps that's a little bit misleading because right now we tend to set our Georges Bank yellowtail flounder ABCs every year through the track process. So in essence, it gets changed every year anyway. But if we should ever lengthen out that gap, you know, these quotas would be set for a couple of years in advance. If you look at the 90% or the estimated catch approach, one of the big advantages to it is that it's closer to the planned fishing activity. We, meaning the scallop PDT, actually sits down and tries to estimate the yellowtail catch once they know what their fishing activity is going to be like. So it more closely takes into account whether access areas are open, whether people are moving between southern New England and Georges Bank scallop fisheries. It has an automatic adjustment built in so that as we update these estimates of what they're going to catch, we can adjust the ABC periodically. The cons are it's complicated. Estimating the catch has a lot of uncertainty in it, and quite honestly, the predictions have been mixed performance. Sometimes they do well, sometimes they don't do so well. Now, if we start to look at some specific allocations, the first thing I'd like to point out is that the reason you got, I pointed out document 13, is that since the groundfish and scallop committees, which were held last week, the estimates of the scallop fishery catches of Georges Bank and Southern New England Yellowtail Flounder for next year have been revised. Now, on the screen, I'm only showing the medium values that are in the tables that are in the document. There is a little bit of a range for Southern New England and a broader range for Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder, which is explained in document 8 in the scallop binder section, scallop section of your binder. But if you look at Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder, for example, you'll see that the estimates declined, in some cases by a pretty good amount. The estimates of the scallop fishery catch are smaller than they were a week ago. And bluntly, this is because we found a mistake in the estimates that we prepared last week. If you look at Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Yellowtail Flounder, however, the estimates went up. In some cases, they roughly doubled from what they were when the scallop committee and the groundfish committee looked at them the past week. So that's the first thing to note when we're talking about the specifics, is that this has been changed. So if we look at the specific allocations, you can see that they will have different effects for the fisheries dependent on which options are taken. And it's basically a linear relationship here. This stuff all plots out on a line. What I'm showing here in this chart and the chart in your binders is that if you look at the scallop sub-ABC on the bottom, and you can tell what the groundfish sub-ACL on the vertical axis would be. So you can see that at 8% and a 500 metric ton ABC, the scallop fishery gets around 20 metric tons, and the groundfish fishery gets around 160 metric tons. If you look at alternative 2, it's roughly 80 and roughly 100. 80 for the scallop fishery, roughly 100 for the groundfish fishery. The oval highlights those options or those values that are based on the 90% estimate, and the other two are based on the fixed percentage estimate. So the next thing I'm going to go into in not a whole lot of detail here is, okay, great. These are the numbers. What are some idea of what's sort of the characterization of the economic impacts on both the groundfish and scallop fisheries of these different numbers? I'm going to start with groundfish fishery impacts. These slides are not in your presentation. This work was completed late yesterday. So you won't see these in the presentation, but we will distribute them later. I'd like to take a minute or two to talk about the analysis and just to point out that it's extremely complicated to try and do this. For starters, what you have to realize is the way we're analyzing this in terms of groundfish is we've basically got what is in essence a simulation model that is based on past fishing activity, in this case, fishing year 2011 fishing activity. And we basically construct a model where we sample from that past fishing activity by trip until different ACLs are caught. And then you have to remember that in the groundfish plan, for example, if you catch all of your ace of Gulf of Maine cod, in most instances, you can no longer fish in the Gulf of Maine cod stock area if you're in a sector. That area closes to you. And the same thing happens on Georges Bank. And the same thing happens on Eastern Georges Bank in the statistical areas 561 and 562. So we've got this model which basically samples from these trips and with different quota levels until an area closes, and then there can't be any more trips in that area. And that's, in a nutshell, kind of how the model works. It's a fleet-wide model. So it's not really sector-specific, and it's entirely possible that, and there are some sectors that do a better job of avoiding cod or avoiding Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder, for example, than other sectors. And by looking at a fleet-wide model, we're kind of glossing over those differences to some extent, and so we're sort of looking at an average performance. As I pointed out, it's based on past fishing activity. So to the extent that people decide to fish differently, then it may not completely capture those differences. Now, it captures some of them. What do I mean by that? Well, we had some trips in 2011 that caught a whole lot of haddock and didn't catch any yellowtail flounder. And this model will sample from those trips. But, you know, it doesn't make every trip from those trips. And so, you know, if people get better at it, you know, the model may overestimate the declines in revenues some. It might. It doesn't really take into account stock size changes. And this could be important. You know, many of our stock size changes are not terribly dramatic from one year to the next. But, for example, Georges Bank haddock could be a dramatic stock size change next year. We're going to see some of the, I think it's 2010 year class showing up in the catch. You know, so the model may underestimate some of those things. So it's kind of the best we can do, but I just want to point out that there are some caveats with how we do this in the case of the groundfish fishery. The other thing to remember is it's difficult, and you really can't isolate one stock and say, well, how does changing Georges Bank yellowtail quotas result in changing the revenues? I mentioned before that we don't know the two cod stocks, and they're critical to groundfish revenue performance. Not only is cod extremely valuable on its own, but it's caught with a lot of things. It makes a lot of trips profitable. So where the cod quotas wind up can have a huge impact on where these revenues turn out. So basically what we did is we set the model with a fixed cod, Gulf of Maine cod and Georges Bank cod quota, which is basically the midpoint of the range that's in the document. And it's admittedly a large range. And then we analyzed three Georges Bank yellowtail flounder sub-ACLs. We analyzed 100 metric tons, which is the sub-ACL pretty close to the alternative two. It's perhaps a little bit higher, or it's right at it. We analyzed 350 metric tons. That would be about what the groundfish fleet would get if the ABC was 1,150 metric tons. And we analyzed 225 metric tons, which doesn't fall anywhere on that chart, but it's right in the middle. So it kind of gives us an idea of how some number in between would change. The first thing I'd like to mention is that we focus on Georges Bank yellowtail flounder, but don't forget that we're expecting pretty large reductions in cod quotas next year. We already know that we've got some pretty big reductions in things like witch flounder, Gulf of Maine yellowtail flounder, Gulf of Maine haddock, a number of species where there are pretty big reductions in the available quota. And so, you know, the thing to remember is that overall we're expecting a decline in gross groundfish revenues next year. And some of these analyses suggest that the decline could be pretty big. How big? Well, maybe 50% less than fishing year 2011 in terms of groundfish revenues. Maybe 60% less than 2011 groundfish revenues. So that's kind of the scale we're talking about here, that the groundfish fishery, you know, absent the decision on yellowtail, is kind of facing a major reduction in revenues in fishing year 2013. Yeah, that's... And unfortunately, we don't really know what the cod quotas are yet. We won't know what those are till January. So we don't really know exactly where we're going to turn out here. I think a key point here is that, yes, Georges Bank yellowtail flounder matters to the groundfish fishery. Gross revenues at the mid-Georges Bank yellowtail flounder value, the 225 metric ton value, which is pretty high, that's higher than a 215-ton ABC, for example, are about 40% higher than they would be at the low value of 100 metric tons. So this shows you that, you know, going from 100 or above 100 metric tons, the Georges Bank yellowtail flounder does influence the revenues. Interestingly enough, you start to go above that and you get some diminishing returns, and you kind of look at that and you kind of squint your eyebrows and say, why does that happen? Well, it's because if you have a large amount of Georges Bank yellowtail flounder, or I shouldn't say a large amount, I should say a larger amount of Georges yellowtail flounder, it doesn't do you a whole lot of good, because Georges Bank cod, and in particular Eastern Georges Bank cod and some other stocks, start to constrain the fishery more than Georges Bank yellowtail flounder. So this is an indication of some of the interactions that go on. I think the high value was 350 metric tons. When we run the model at the high value, the gross revenues are actually a little bit lower than they are at the 225 metric ton value, which, as I said, doesn't seem to make sense until you realize that what's happening is the other things are constraining the fishery before they start bumping up against the Georges Bank yellowtail flounder. I'm going to move on to scallops. And the scallop fishery impacts are perhaps a little bit more certain. They are, however, analyzed in a very different way. You know, this fishery is far more predictable because they know how much everybody's fishing for scallops, for starters, and they have a pretty good idea of how much they can catch. But it was analyzed in perhaps a little bit unusual way, and I want to explain it a little bit, and if I get in over my head, Deirdre can explain the rest of it. But basically, there are two broad-scale options here. There's a fixed percentage option, the 8 or 16%, and there's the 90% of estimated catch option. In the fixed percentage options, the allocations are well below what the scallop fishery is expected to catch, even the new versions of the allocations that we distributed this morning. And so what the scallop PDT did is they said, okay, if these are adopted, let's kind of assume that an alternative has to be modified to reduce the Georges Bank yellowtail flounder bycatch. In other words, they said, look, you know, you're not going to have catches at this low a level unless you modify the scallop alternative. And how much would you have to modify that alternative in order to fit under this allocation? And that's the cost of this option. They also looked at the likelihood under each of these scenarios that the accountability would be measure would be triggered 1 year and lead to a closure the next year. The 90% option, they looked at it slightly differently. They say, well, you know, the allocations are closer to the expected catch, so you probably wouldn't have to modify the options in the first year, but it's likely that the AM would be triggered in 2014. So what would that cost the scallop fishery if that happened? So with the fixed percentage options, they look at it and they say, basically, if you went with a fixed percentage options and either scallop management alternative 2 or 4, you probably have to close closed area 2 in 2013, and it would probably close in 2014 due to the AM being triggered, particularly at the 8% level. At the 16% level, there's a lower risk that the AM would be triggered, but it's still possible or probable. And so if you look at this, I think the columns with numbers in them are 2013, 2014 in total for the 2 years. And I think if you kind of focus on the bottom here where it's the present value of scallop revenue, and then the present value of revenue after the closures, you can see the difference. So in other words, in 2013, under Alternative 2, they're predicting $382 million of scallop revenues. If they had to change that alternative in order to account for a fixed percentage allocation, then it would be $358 million in revenue. So, you know, a loss of whatever that is, $24 million in revenue to the scallop fishery. And that's how you interpret this table. With the 90% option, again, we wouldn't change anything in 2013, but there's a pretty good chance that closed area 2 would have to be closed in 2014 because the AM would be likely to be exceeded. And if you look at that, then you don't really have any changes in revenues in 2013, but you can see that the changes in revenues in 2014 that are on the previous slide show up on this slide as well. So in other words, in 2014, under the alternative as structured, they think the revenues are going to be about $374 million. If you had to closed area 2 in response to the AM being triggered, the revenues would drop to $357 million, or about roughly a $16 million drop in revenues due to that. So that summarizes in a very broad scale the questions you're facing in gives you some idea of the scale of the impacts on both the groundfish fisheries and the scallop fisheries of the different choices. I think there's really about four decisions, allocation decisions, to try and wrestle through today. The first is the U.S.-Canada tax. Specifically, the one issue here is the Georgia's yellowtail tax. Then the Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder allocation method, and then to get into the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic fishery, Southern New England Mid-Atlantic yellowtail allocation method, and the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic windowpane approach.
Terry.
Do you want to... Okay, thank you. Thanks, Tom, for teeing it off. These are going to be four very difficult motions to make. The first one, in order to get things going, I'm going to make on my behalf of myself, because the committee did not make a recommendation for the U.S. Canada. So I'm going to move that the council approve the following 2013 quotas for the U.S. Canada resource sharing understanding. One, Eastern Georgia's Bank cod, 600 metric tons, with the U.S. share of 96 metric tons and the Canadian share of 504. Two, the Eastern Georgia's Bank haddock, 10,400 metric tons, with the U.S. share of 3952 metric tons and the Canadian share of 6448. And three, the Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder, 500 metric tons, U.S. share 215, Canadian share 285.
Seconded by Tom Dempsey. Discussion. Terry.
Very difficult discussion. I'm keenly aware of the economic impacts. The TMGC struggled through this over a better part of a day in St. Andrews. The 500 tons is the upper max of the track recommendations. It's consistent with the TMGC recommendation. Concerned that if we moved ahead the 1150, we'd blow up the steering committee steering agreement, and trading would be never a consideration in the future.
I'm going to go to the audience and ask for comments on this, and then I'll bring it back to the council. Anyone in the audience? Vito and Drew.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Gigoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. The following discussion about the split between the scallop and ground fishery on the yellowtail stock is going to be a tough one, and it's certainly based not on how best to utilize that stock. It's based on the 218 or 215 ton that we've got there. So I realize this has been repeated at many groundfish committee meetings, and I believe the last council meeting, that this is a serious problem. I think the mayor did a good job of articulating that we all respect the agreement, and we think the agreement is important, and we can't unilaterally break the agreement. But at all costs, spare embarrassment, I think it's absolutely important that we consider going back and seeing if there's anything, both scientifically and diplomatically, to get additional yellowtail, either from the Canadians, which I think is a lot less likely at this point, but late in the game, but maybe more likely to reconsider the track recommendation between 200 and 500 ton. So we just want to go on record that we believe this is basically surrendering to a policy that's going to potentially collapse one or both fisheries.
Drew?
Thank you. Drew Minkiewicz, Fishery Survival Fund. Obviously, it's no secret that we have serious concerns and reservations about the results of the track assessment with regards to Georgia's Bank yellowtail. Noted that several times in front of you. I hope, know some of you were able to see Dr. Cadron's presentation last night about the significant concerns the scientific community has with the assessment. By accepting 500 metric tons as an upper bound, you're accepting that it's okay in the middle of an assessment process to change the rules and change the model without the whole peer review process. voting for this motion, you validate that practice. So you want to think twice before you do that. You also are validating an assessment that says that the survey results would be more than 100% efficient, herding or not, of yellowtail, that it would be more than 100% efficient for the survey results to match up with this model result. So if you vote for this motion, you're saying, I believe that the survey net catches more than 100% of the yellowtail that it encounters. None go under the sweep, none go over the net, and it actually brings them in from a further area, herds them up, and catches them all. That's what you're saying if you vote for this assessment, this motion here. And I understand the concerns about, you know, upsetting the agreement, but let's look at the numbers in front of us of what this agreement's getting us. There are 600 metric tons of Eastern Georgia's bank cod that both countries have agreed to be caught, and we've negotiated ourselves a healthy 96 metric tons of those 600 tons. Well done. There are 500 metric tons of yellowtail to be caught. We've negotiated ourselves 215 metric tons of those. Once again, well done. 10,000 metric tons of haddock to be caught, and we've caught negotiated ourselves under 4,000 metric tons. So if this agreement were to be blown up, where exactly do we get hurt? Do we only get 90 metric tons then of Georgia's bank cod compared to the 96 that we're getting under our strategy so far? So I think we really need to look at, you know, if this is truly a shared stock, yet we seem to be doing a lot more giving than taking here. This isn't really an equal relationship, and we need to really question about what we're doing here in this with this agreement. So with all of those concerns, I strongly urge you not to support this motion and to go back to Canada for something that, one, resembles the reality of the fish that are out there, and two, that it actually gets us something more on par with what we actually deserve as part of a sharing agreement rather than a giving agreement that it is right now.
Anyone? Peter?
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for allowing me to make some brief comments. This is going to be very difficult. Both fisheries are almost set up to fail. We're in a sense, pitting brother against brother, fisherman against fisherman, in this allocation fight because there's not enough fish. I don't want to do that. I know that others don't want that to happen either. But there's not enough fish as a whole to make each fishery whole. The scallop fishery is in a position where we are almost, in a sense, set up to fail. And nobody wants to see that happen. We listened to Dr. Cadron last night explain some of the SSC's recommendations, and the SSC was recommending 1,150 metric tons as a bycatch-only fishery. And I think that that should seriously be taken into consideration by this council. And you know, like Drew said, you know, these numbers are not healthy numbers for a U.S. domestic fishery. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Okay, I'll bring it back to the council. David Pierce.
In Tom's presentation, again, this is related to the motion. In Tom's presentation, I don't believe he noted one aspect of the Groundfish Committee discussion that pertains to how much yellowtail must be set aside for different components of the U.S. fishery. Specifically, I mentioned, and Terry can address this as chair, that there's an 18% or so requirement, if indeed this council goes in that direction. I assume it's going to be obliged to do so, about 18% for the smallmouth fishery on Georgia's Bank, the whiting fishery, and the like. So we're not just talking about an allocation of whatever is available between ground fishermen and between scallopers. We're talking about another bin into which yellowtail must be deposited, a large amount, 18% for the smallmouth fishery, whiting specifically. That cannot be ignored. We're doing hard quota management, therefore we have to find every fish that's going to be caught and counted against that fishery in some overall ECL. So, you know, that's significant. That's more yellowtail needed for another fishery, which means less for the scallopers and less for the ground fishermen. So I think about that. I also think about the, again, the presentations that were given yesterday. Fisherman Survival Fund sponsored a very good forum, and we had some very well-done presentations by a number of individuals, VIMS, SMAST, two from SMAST, T.K. Dremt, and Kate O'Keefe, specifically very compelling information. One part of the presentation related to the very responsible, very well-received on our part initiative by SMAST and the Scallop Fishery to avoid bycatch for the bycatch avoidance program. They've done a lot to deal with yellowtail flounder bycatch. And frankly, I don't want to take any actions, notably this motion, I don't want to take any action that would result in a very likely end to their bycatch avoidance program, because the program will not be needed if there really won't be any access to Georgia's Bank closed area 2 to take yellowtail, which would happen with this particular motion if we adopt it. So that weighs on my mind. In addition, it's very likely, if not a certainty, that this particular motion, if adopted for yellowtail flounder, U.S.-Canadian share, I think we almost automatically say right now, today, that we will accept the fact that accountability measures for sea scallops will kick in 2014, so we'll have some very significant large closures to the sea scallop fishery as a consequence of Georgia's Bank yellowtail. So there's a lot at stake here, looking forward to the future, the near future, and what it means for the scallop fishery as well as the groundfish fishery. And Tom just noted the importance of yellowtail, Georgia's Bank yellowtail, to the groundfish fishery. He gave us some numbers. I'm struggling to catch up with Tom because a lot of this is new in terms of numbers being seen for the first time. All right, so that's all weighing on my mind. And then I think about what this council did at our last meeting. I don't think we can just discount what we did at our last meeting, which is a motion that passed unanimously, 17-0-0, where we said that we would consider, this council would consider, as part of the package, the SSC recommended ABC of 1,150 metric tons as the bycatch fishery. That should be included in the Framework 48 analysis. If we do this, it's dumped out. It's not going to be considered. We go to the lowball number of 215 metric tons. So to me, it's a rather remarkable step we would take relative to conscious effort on our part to do severe damage to the scallop and the groundfish fishery. So I cannot support this motion because of what's before us now relative to the Canadian share, the U.S. Canadian share for Georgia's Bank yellowtail, for the reasons I have mentioned, and I've got others I won't get into, and, of course, what the SSC has given us. We have something from the SSC that is an ABC. Yes, it's not technically an OFL, but what do they give us? They give us the ABCs. That's their charge, and they gave it to us. It's legit. It's in play. It's not out of play. Yes, it's not consistent with what came out of the track. I understand that. But I do believe that it is important for our U.S. representative to reengage with the Canadians on this particular issue because of what we know, strongly suspect, if not definitely know, will happen to our scallop fishery and our groundfish fishery. That has to be looked at again by the National Marine Fisheries Service specifically. I understand the position. There's not really a desire to go back to the Canadians in that regard. Yes, go back and trade Georgia's Bank yellowtail for haddock, but still, I don't think that's going to be enough, especially in light of some of the data I see in tables before me, Table 15, that was referenced by Tom Neese. That's in document number 13. When we look at the last part of that table, we see that with an 8% share or a 16% share for the scallop fishery, we end up with an allocation of Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder of about 34 metric tons, which is, I think, far less than what we can expect to be taken by the scallop fishery on Georgia's Bank this coming year, far less than what I believe will be taken. So accountability measures will trigger. All right. I would move to amend. I would move to amend this motion so that instead of our saying at the very end, 500 metric tons, U.S. share 250 metric tons, and Canadian share 285, I would change that to 1,150 metric tons, and then in parentheses, the U.S. share is 495 metric tons, and the Canadian 656 metric tons. That's my motion to amend.
Is there a second to that motion? Mary Beth. John.
Well, I was going to say that I was going to speak in favor of the original motion, so I'll say that I'm going to speak in opposition to the amendment. I went to the meeting of the SSC. You all know I'm not a scientist, but I listened carefully to the SSC meeting. I listened carefully last night to the presentation. I thought a lot of the presentation last night was very good about bycatch avoidance. I'm encouraged by it. I'm encouraged by how well the groundfish industry has shown they can avoid yellowtail. I'm encouraged by the partnership with the scallop industry and SMAST at how well they can avoid yellowtail. I wish there were more yellowtail and we didn't have this difficult decision in front of us. I wish the science were more clear about it and we didn't have this retrospective problem. At the SSC, I listened to the criticism of the science, and I listened to the SSC asked repeatedly if they would like to reject the track report, and repeatedly they said no, they did not want to reject the track. The track recommended 200 and 300 and 500. They didn't just recommend 500. They recommended 200 and 300. And they said 500 was the upper limit at a risk of overfishing. And the SSC was asked repeatedly, would you, with all of the criticisms of the science behind those numbers, 200 and 300 and 500, with all of the criticism, would you like to reject that report? And repeatedly the SSC said, no, we're not going to reject that report with all its weaknesses. And so then towards the end of that discussion in that hotel in Boston, someone said, we want to offer another number, 1150. We're going to call it a backstop. I've never heard of this number before, a backstop. I still don't know what it means. They said, you know, with all of this argument, we're not denying the low numbers of yellowtail, and we advise that the fishery be a bycatch-only fishery, which I think is, while it's inappropriate that the SSC get into management advice, I suspect that all of us on the council welcome that and understand the tenor with which that advice is made. You know, that's probably good advice and warranted. But the 1150, I'm not sure what backstop is, but that's what it was. Someone said that from the audience that they recommended 1150. I didn't take that as a recommended number. It wasn't a recommended number. It was offered as backstop, whatever that means. So I wouldn't call it best available science. It wasn't offered that way. I don't think it meets that definition. I'm going to oppose this motion, and if it carries, we'll oppose it later.
If I can, for a moment, I'll take off my hat as chair of this of the council and just make some comments as chair of the TMGC. I made some of these comments at a previous Groundfish Committee meeting, but some of the comments that were made concerning the TMGC process, I just want to put out some information concerning that. When the agreement was originally crafted, it was at that point that how the allocations would be determined were set for the future of the agreement. It started out with distribution having a smaller impact and has moved to a distribution having a very substantial impact on how the allocations are done. But those, at the time that agreement was done, the U.S. Side was very content with that. We agreed to how that would be done over the future. It doesn't mean we can't try and go back and readdress that. We did bring it up at this year's negotiations. It was not warmly received by our Canadian colleagues, but there wasn't an absolute we can't negotiate that. So when you look at the numbers it certainly looks like we're getting a bad deal on the allocation, but that is the split that we agreed to when this agreement was originally crafted. The idea of our being able to go back a fourth time to try and renegotiate, this is my own personal feelings and having discussions with some of the of our Canadian colleagues during the negotiations, is that I see two outcomes to our going back. One is that the best outcome is that they say no to the 500, to increasing the 500 metric tons. The worst case scenario is that they decide that this agreement is no longer working because we have done this now four separate times. They have had great reservations about the impacts of the SSC on the decisions that come from the United States on this agreement. That is why, as the way that the agreement was crafted, was that the information that the science that will inform the decision comes through the track. And that is the way that it has been done before. When we went back the last time and renegotiated, because our SSC did come out with a higher number, but that higher number was within the advice given by TRAC, and that's what gave us the opportunity to go back. And in this situation, it is way outside of what the TRAC is. So I'm just putting that out there on the table, just because some comments had been made about how the negotiating process goes on. Got Dave Preble and then David Pierce and Chairman Roth.
Yeah, I just wanted to also say that I was on that on the TMGC at the time that we went back to the Canadians, and it was not a pleasant experience. It's not something that I think we can repeat, and I'm in no doubt that if we go back that it will blow up the agreement. And it's not going to be a case of go back and maybe they'll just say no. I don't think that's going to happen. I think they're going to blow up the agreement. And I would consider that to be a disaster for the U.S. because as time moves on, we're going to have to increase our negotiating ability with the Canadians, particularly in light of the changes that we're seeing in climate and the distribution of fish. We know fish are moving north and east, and that's right into their waters. So I don't see how we can, in looking at the future, how we can seriously entertain the notion of blowing up that agreement.
David Pierce.
Yeah, regarding looking into the future, this has implications, of course, for 2014 and 2015. We may as well kiss the sea scallop fishery goodbye in many areas of the Georges Bank, and we may as well be willing to suffer the tremendous socioeconomic consequences that will occur with a lowball number that we'll be struggling to live with for who knows how many years. This has long-term implications. So if the understanding is going to be jeopardized, then maybe it's time to put it in jeopardy because of the U.S. interests that are completely disregarded, I suspect. Well, I believe the interests are completely disregarded with the higher number. Now, I'll offer up one other point relative to my motion, and that is today is groundfish, tomorrow is scallops. All right. The scallop committee has offered up some motions for this council to consider relative to the different alternatives for scallops, and each one of those alternatives that we will discuss tomorrow has implications as to what the expected Georges Bank yellowtail flounder catch will be. So I reference Table 15 again in the document that was given to us this morning, and I see that with the 500 metric tons to be split between both nations, with a 16% share for the sea scallop fishery, we end up with 34 metric tons. All right. Now I go up into the table, higher up in the table, I go to alternative two under scallop framework 24 management alternatives, and I see the expected scallop fishery catch. All right. All of those numbers, low anticipated catch, medium, high, they are larger than the 34.4 metric tons. So if this council adopts in a subsequent motion the 16% share, then how in the world can we seriously entertain the Sea Scallop Committee's motions tomorrow as to alternative two being the preferred alternative? It actually drags us to alternative four, and even then the numbers aren't big enough to satisfy the needs of the scallop fishery, notwithstanding the fact that they're being very responsible and trying to avoid yellowtail flounder, and they're initiating an expansion of that avoidance program. Now, looking at the bottom of that table again, on the 16%, you see 79.2 metric tons. That would correspond to the 1150 number, 79.2. Now we're getting closer to what the scallop fishery would require, what is likely to catch under alternative number two. So we're getting close. Not quite there, but we're getting close. So I suggest that if we do not adopt the motion to amend, we have put ourselves in a position where the scallop alternatives offered up to us tomorrow from the scallop committee, the preferred alternatives, they're out the door. They're no longer meaningful. So we've got a bit of a disconnect having groundfish tomorrow and scallops tomorrow with this issue being overlapping between both committees. So I still stand by the motion. It is defensible, especially in the context of SSC advice to us. And it is worthwhile going back to the Canadians and at the same time understanding that I'll stop there. This motion is key to the survival of the scallop fishery and certainly the groundfish fishery that is already hard-pressed to survive. And, of course, we know what has recently been declared a groundfish disaster.
Rick Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your description of the TMGC discussions and sharing that additional background with us. I think it's important. In the short run, this has set up a conflict between two of the region's most important fisheries, and yet it's going to be a long-term problem and a long-term issue. I think it's something that we're going to have to all work together to develop a long-term solution to. Just looking at the track results, it's not just a one-year downturn. There are four-year classes that are weak in that assessment. And until we can get better science, that's the understanding of that resource that we have. And so we need to develop some long-term solutions. And just thinking about the transboundary agreement, frankly, I think it falls short of our needs. It was developed at a time well before Magnuson was reauthorized. It was developed at a time before there were annual catch limits and the attendant accountability measures that we're now operating under that have such significant implications for management and for the fishing communities. And so I think what we ultimately need is a strategic approach to revisiting that agreement. I appreciate the fact that in the short run, if you go back to the well, you anticipate an outcome that could be negative. But I think in the long run, we do need to reapproach that agreement and review it. There's absolutely no consideration of the importance of these respective allocations or different allocation scenarios to the fishing communities. So we might end up with an outcome that's simply driven by the spatial distribution of fish without any consideration of economics or the social implications of those different scenarios. So we end up with this potentially untenable outcome, in my mind, where the Canadians are going to receive an allocation of fish that don't generate any more than the ex-vessel value of those yellowtail at the dock, while we potentially cause tens of millions of dollars of impacts in the U.S. fisheries. So I think it's going to be almost impossible for us operating within that agreement to preserve the interests of the U.S. fisheries going forward. I think we have to revisit the way that agreement is structured and the way the allocations are modeled. And again, I realize that's not something that gets you out of this today's cycle from a decision-making standpoint, but I think it is something that we need to address going forward because the problem's not going to go away. I mean, these fish are going to continue to be dynamic in their distributions. The fact that the allocation considers that, I think, is on the one hand a good thing, but on the other hand, again, the fact that the allocation models don't consider the impacts or the importance of those allocations between the fisheries is really a fatal shortcoming. Thank you.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things. One is the agency's interpretation of the ABC recommendations of the SSC. The council asked the SSC to provide us with a range of ABCs to consider, and they did that. And their report is really very clear. They made two recommendations that are based on the track, and the third one in their report is an ABC, not just a backstop, but an ABC of 1,150 metric ton. So I think the report is very clear. It's part of the range of ABCs provided by the scientific body that gives advice to this council. It's not ambiguous or in any way. And for the agency to interpret it as not being an ABC when it clearly says in the report that that is the recommendation is incorrect. So that's just one issue. The other as far as the track process, I participated this year for the first year, and I didn't understand why we were not going to bring forward the SSC recommendation during our discussions in any way, and we did not. But, you know, I was advised that the track was going to be constraining on our discussions, and I didn't see a way to get around it at that time. I was very disappointed. I thought we should have discussed the SSC recommendation. We did not. And then after our decision, on this particular issue, some of the Canadians said that they actually would have gone to a higher number, a number outside of what the track advice was that we felt so constrained by. And so I understand people's concerns about going back. We've gone back a number of times, and we don't know what the outcome of that might be. So that's uncertain. But we do know, you know, have a very good idea of what the outcome of sticking with this number is going to be and the impacts it's going to cause in both the scallop and groundfish fisheries. And I just find that unacceptable. And that is why I seconded the motion, and that is why I support it.
John Bullard.
Certainly very aware of the ability of yellowtail flounder to leverage a healthy and fishery and scallops that provides a lot of jobs and huge positive economic impact to the region and in my hometown. I also want us to keep in mind that what's in front of us today is a decision on yellowtail flounder, and our mission, I think, I'm new here, is to rebuild yellowtail flounder. I think that's what's in front of us. The goal is rebuilding yellowtail flounder.
I have Jim Weinberg, and then Gene, and Dave Gaethel, Dave Preble, Mark Gibson.
Thank you. I just wanted to repeat some of the major results of the assessment by the track, because a lot of that happened when that report came to you. It's been quite a while. And in a nutshell, what the report found was that the spawning stock biomass is currently at about one-tenth of the rebuilding target, that recruitment during the last 3 years has been at historic low values, and that the estimate of the fishing mortality rate has been very high. In fact, for the last 30 years, the model estimates that the rate of fishing has exceeded the overfishing threshold. Another thing that the report emphasizes, it points out that the stock assessment had a lot of uncertainty, and that was discussed very much during the TRAC meeting. And in response to that, there was a lot of discussion about whether to accept this or not, and in the end they did decide to go forward with it. But because of all the uncertainty, they did five different sensitivity analyses with making different assumptions about what might have occurred. And the bottom line there that's important now is that in four of those five sensitivity analyses that they did, they found that if the total removals were greater than 500 metric tons, it was greater than a 50% chance that overfishing would be occurring. So I just wanted to point that out as a representative from of the Science Center. And I attended part of the track meeting, and I just felt that I wanted to clarify what the conclusions were. And I didn't take part in the process. I didn't do the analyses, and I wasn't a reviewer, but I have the report in front of me, and this is what it said. Thank you.
Gene Martin.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to a couple of comments that suggest that because the SSC has recommended 1150 as a upper bound in a bycatch-only fishery, that automatically means that the council, the PDT, the analysis can avoid other legal requirements that exist. It may make sense in a vacuum that doesn't have legal constraints, to adopt the approach of 1150 in a bycatch-only fishery. But unfortunately, we have the overlay of legal requirements. The SSC does not exempt by its recommendations the requirement for the council and the agency to consider these other legal requirements. Now, the most obvious legal requirement that would have to be reconciled if this motion is adopted is that overfishing will be prevented. That's an immutable requirement under the law, under National Standard 1, under the guidelines, and under a couple other provisions in the Madison-Stevens Act. If it's not possible to reconcile 1150 with the requirement to prevent overfishing, then it's not that recommendation for an ACL would not be consistent with requirements in the Madison-Stevens Act. And the fact that the fact that the SSC recommended this without, by the way, providing any recommendations on what the OFL, the overfishing limit, should be in light of this recommendation, does not exempt the requirement to have ACLs prevent overfishing. That's not a negotiable, it's not a flexible system here. Regardless of the obvious potential negative impacts on scallop and groundfish fisheries, which is a hard dilemma to resolve, and probably can't be resolved, but it exists there. So keep that in mind in the vote here. I'm not, you know, there's some concerns here about what I guess another standard that's at issue here is National Standard 2,
which requires to use the best scientific information available. And I understand there's some disagreement as to what the best scientific information available is, but the policy is that the recommendations of the peer-reviewed assessment system is the best scientific information available. So keep those legal requirements in mind. Keep in mind that the SSC's recommendation does not exempt you from those legal requirements, regardless of what they say, and those must be reconciled in the analysis here.
Dave Gaethel.
Okay. Well, let's see. How much worse exactly can it get? That seems to be the argument for people who say we got to adopt the 500 metric tons. It could get much worse. My feeling is, how much worse can it get? The scallop fishery and the groundfish fishery are going to shut down. Not they might shut down. They are going to shut down if you adopt this number. That's number one. So how much worse can it get? They're going to shut down whatever number you adopt. The second myth that's out there is that if we don't adopt the 500 tons, the Canadians won't trade with us. Well, gee, no matter where I look at it, if you adopt this number, you can't trade your way out of the problem anyway. If they give you all the yellowtails that exist on Georges Bank, you still don't have enough fish to keep these fisheries from shutting down. So again, I will reiterate, what difference does it make? Third, I think we had a science forum last Friday in Portsmouth, and I said at that forum several things. And one of them is that you have to admit when you have a problem. And as they famously beamed back from the moon one time, Houston, we have a problem. Changing Q, row adjustments. So many statistical sleight of hands have been applied to this stock assessment that it should be rejected. It's time to admit that this stock assessment is broken and send it back to be redone and reexamined from soup to nuts. The reference point is real unrealistic in light of current environmental conditions on Georges Bank. And therefore, it's giving you an unrealistic number that's leading to this definition of the stock being in an overfishing condition if we adopt another number. That's how you're getting this number. If you had a realistic reference point, you probably wouldn't have overfishing occurring if you adopted a higher number. And last, I'd like to say, I think at some point, it's time to stand up and do the right thing, even if you get shot down for it. At least as an individual, I'm not like Jim Jones. I'm not going to drink the Kool-Aid and march blindly off the edge of the cliff. It's time to stand up and admit there's a problem here and it needs to be fixed. And if it blows up the whole thing, so be it. It can't get any worse. So I support Dr. Pierce's motion. Thank you.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to refer to what Mary Beth and Rick said. I strongly support them on that concept. We need to have a long-term change in the agreement. That agreement is obsolete. There's no question in my mind about that. The last time I spoke with the Canadians when I was part of that process, they didn't understand what the SSC was or even how our science worked. So we need to make some long-term changes, but that's a long-term solution. It doesn't solve this year's problem. The other thing is that there is another fishery on Eastern Georges Bank, and I know this isn't germane exactly to this situation, but there's another fishery out there that we are taking a very tiny percentage of the allowed TAC. And I think that as an aside and not directly relating to the yellowtail thing, that we need to be looking at any changes that we've already changed gear or allowed change in gear to allow the groundfish to take redfish. And I think we need to look at any possible long-term changes any possible changes in the gear that's currently used to take haddock. If there's anything we can do to enable the fleet to increase their take of haddock, I think we need to explore that. But that isn't related to this problem. I just want to throw that in.
Mark Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thank David Pierce for making this motion. I support it, even though I share concerns about the 1150 number and whether it's a viable number for the council to consider. I'm not sure what a backstop means either in this motion. Doesn't even speak to it being a backstop. But I think the threats to the U.S. fishing industry is so grave, not to the Canadians, that this council has to make a very strong statement. So I was swayed by Chairman Robbins' points about the transboundary agreement and how it's obsolete relative to reauthorized Magnuson. Found that a compelling argument. And I also believe, like Dave Gaethel, that this yellowtail stock assessment has some serious problems, but the stock itself has some serious problems, and its ability to rebuild, I think, is even more in question than the winter flounder information I presented at the forum. So I think the council needs to send a very strong message that we're essentially desperate here and need to accomplish something for the U.S. industry. I'm prepared to jeopardize the transboundary agreement if that's in fact what happens. And I'm also prepared to jeopardize yellowtail rebuilding if in fact that's what happens. That's what I think we have to do, so I support it. Thank you.
John Quinn.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I support the amendment as amended by Dr. Pierce. I know coming up in March we have a risk analysis workshop, and we probably should have had that before this meeting, because this is really a comparison of risk. On one hand, on the agreement side, risking of blowing it up, risk of potential problems. But as I heard Chairman Robbins say, that maybe its time has come. On the other hand, the tremendous risk to both the scallop and groundfish fishermen, as well as the communities, and I don't think we can de-emphasize the impact on the communities, certainly under National Standard 8. So in my personal risk analysis, I say that it is worth the risk to jeopardize or to have issues with the agreement, rather than the risk is much greater on the other side of the impact on the groundfish scallop industry as well as those communities. So I will be voting yes on the further amendment.
Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there is... this is certainly an attractive number. I mean, it's double what we're currently dealing with, and it feels better. But I think Dr. Pierce raised a really important point about the interplay between the decision we're making right now, the signal that sends, and then the decision that we're making tomorrow with regards to scallop allocation scenarios. I don't think, and based on John's comments and Gene's comments, I don't think that this is an approvable number. But we won't know that tomorrow when we discuss scallop allocation scenarios, choosing effectively, it seems, between 2 and 4, which have very different yellowtail interaction rates. So while I don't think this is ever, I don't actually think this is feasible, we'll make and pass this motion potentially, thinking tomorrow that, well, actually we have 1,150 metric tons to deal with, and I guess it doesn't matter which of these scenarios we choose in scallop, so let's go with alternative 2. But it has real impacts. Alternative 4 clearly allows the scallop fishery to be prosecuted with significantly fewer yellowtail interactions. So I think we need to be realistic. I think that's setting ourselves up to make a misinformed decision tomorrow and perpetuating what I think is a somewhat false hope that we're going to actually be able to implement 1150, even though we may like to. So I think that's problematic, and I'm sensitive to David's perspective that we need to admit when we have a problem. And to Mark's point, yeah, we have an assessment problem, but we have a fish problem out there. There is literally no positive signal in that stock. Ignore the assessment. Just the information that we're getting on that stock, there's nothing positive out there. We have a fish problem on Georgia's Bank with yellowtail flounder, and we need to be serious and call that what it is as well. We definitely have some issues to address with the stock assessment. I'm not going to stand up here and say that that is where it needs to be, but the underlying resource is in serious trouble, and I do believe that our goal and our obligation is to rebuild, and the first step there is to end overfishing. I don't think this motion sends – I don't think it's viable. I don't think it sends the right signal, and I don't think it conforms to our ultimate mission of ending overfishing and rebuilding these stocks. So I can't support it at this time. Thank you.
John Bullard.
I think if you want to send a signal, you certainly send it out. I'm happy to send a signal, too. I think this violates National Standard 1 and Standard 2, and while I'll confer with Gene and Dr. Karp. You know, we'll probably not approve it, but that'll be my signal for today. I do want to address something that that Dave mentioned about this. If you don't approve this, if we go with 500, you definitely shut both fisheries down. With just some information, and that is, if we had 500 metric tons and a U.S. share of 215 and an intact Canadian agreement and a trade and transfer mechanism that would add to that 215 some amount, whatever that might be. So you've got something in excess of 215, whatever that might be. So what is going to be caught this year in yellowtail flounder by the scallop fishery? 221 metric tons. That's what is projected to be caught now by the scallop fishery. And it's hard to say by groundfish, but to date, 60 metric tons. So it's going to be difficult, no question about it. Is it going to be impossible? I don't know, but it's going to be impossible. But the trade and transfer, if we blow up the agreement, yeah, that's going to be out the window. So to the issue of risk that John Quinn, that is germane, the issue of risk, because that's at the table if we blow up the agreement. This is an issue of risk that we are talking about. This is, as Tom mentioned, as others have mentioned, you know, we have a yellowtail stock that is, you know, in really poor condition, and we've got to do something about it. And it's not the medicine is not easy medicine. That's why we all get these. That's why the council members get these high salaries, right? To do this tough medicine.
Matt, Mary Beth.
Well, I do think that Gene raised some issues that would need to be resolved if this motion were to pass, which I hope it would. I don't think his concerns go away, and we would just need to have some further discussion about that. I mean, I think going back to the SSC is an option. I think we should be exploring every option we have available to us at this point. We're not in a very good place. The assessment, you know, the SSC questioned whether it was good for management advice at all. They talked about rejecting the assessment, but quite frankly, they didn't know where to go with, you know, catch advice if they totally rejected it. I think we need to have some further discussions, and I hope the motion passes. Thank you.
Further council discussion? Dave.
No, I just, if this is the end, I want to request a roll call vote.
Okay. I call a question on the motion to amend.
Please read the motion and answer yes, no, or abstain. Mark Alexander.
No.
Terry Alexander. Vincent Balsano.
Yes.
Frank Blount.
No.
John Bullard.
No.
Tom Dempsey.
No.
Mark Gibson.
Yes.
David Gafel.
Yes.
Doug Grout.
No.
Peter Kendall.
Yes.
Matt McKenzie.
No.
David Pierce.
Yes.
Dave Preble. John Quinn.
Yes.
Laura Ramsden.
Yes.
Terry Stockwell.
No.
Mary Beth Tooley.
Yes.
Motion carries 9 to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9 to 8.
Okay, we are on the main motion as amended. Further discussion? Did you want a roll call vote on this one, Dave?
No.
Okay. All those in favor so indicate? Nine in favor. Opposed? Seven. Abstention? One. So nine, seven, one. The motion carries. I think that this might be a good place to take a lunch break.